In the pre-dawn darkness of January 31, 1968, the sacred silence of Vietnam's Tet holiday was shattered. Nearly 10,000 North Vietnamese Army, NVA troops, and Viet Cong guerrillas poured into Hue like a mighty python, streaming across bridges, through fortress gates, and along the wide boulevards of Vietnam's ancient imperial capital. They arrived in waves, by sampans on rivers, on commandeered motorbikes, in captured jeeps. Within hours, the blue and red flag with yellow star of the National Liberation Front flew over the citadel, photographed and broadcast worldwide as a symbol of American vulnerability. This wasn't supposed to happen. Hue was considered safely behind American lines, its population of intellectuals and religious communities largely neutral in the conflict. The fall of this cultural treasure would trigger 24 days of the most intense urban combat Americans had experienced since World War II, and forever change how Americans viewed the Vietnam War. For months before the attack, an elaborate intelligence operation had been underway. Young Vietnamese women posed as hat sellers, mapping military positions and extracting information from soldiers. Weapons were smuggled into the city through ingenious means, duck-selling boats with false bottoms, ammunition hidden in egg baskets, and guards distracted with moonshine. The attack's timing was devastating. Many South Vietnamese troops were on holiday leave, and American leadership was complacent. General Westmoreland had declared that the end begins to come into view. When the assault began at 2:30 a.m., Marine advisor Frank Dozema nearly lost his leg to an RPG. Jim Coolican improvised a tourniquet, completed the amputation with his knife, and carried his semi-conscious friend to safety. By sunrise, the ancient imperial city had fallen in just 3 hours, with the communist banner replacing the South Vietnamese flag. The battle for Hue had begun, though American commanders refused to believe it. Despite overwhelming evidence of Hue's fall, American leadership remained in denial. General Westmoreland reported only approximately 3 companies of enemy troops, underestimating their strength by a factor of 20. This deadly miscalculation led commanders to dispatch just over 300 Marines against 10,000 enemy fighters. Captain Batchelor's convoy entered a nightmare as they drove into Hue, racing through what resembled a town in an old Western movie under heavy fire. At a traffic circle, Batchelor was hit 3 times while helping a wounded man, breaking his femur. He ordered Gunnery Sergeant John Candley to take command. Captain Meadows and his men attempted to cross the damaged Trung Tien Bridge into the citadel, fully exposed to enemy fire. The NVA opened fire midway, inflicting heavy casualties. Devastating fire from the citadel walls forced Meadows to retreat with 7 dead and 45 wounded, over half his company. These Marines, many just teenagers who'd been told they faced minor resistance, were suddenly thrust into the most intense urban combat since World War II. By nightfall, as the reality of Hue's fall became undeniable, the question wasn't how to win the city back, but at what cost. Communist forces established headquarters at Tu Dam Pagoda, a 17th-century tower unlikely to be bombed due to its historical significance. Liberation Radio broadcast throughout the country, calling on people to rise up against the traitorous government. Young commissars began remaking Hue, condemning Western fashions, confiscating property, and forcing citizens to dig trenches. Some families were ordered to create fake bamboo weapons to intimidate American forces. Initially, many residents displayed red flags in support, but sentiment quickly shifted as systematic purges began. What started as justice against government officials devolved into horror. Writer Tran Thi Thu Van documented the nightmare. Her musician uncle killed by artillery. Families executed for possessing televisions mistaken for communication devices. And Vietnamese-American toddlers murdered as children of American imperialists. From across the river, she watched as Dong Ba Market has become flat ground, while downtown vanished under smoke. With explosions, dust and bricks and tiles fly up, throwing corpses up into the air. Foreign civilians weren't spared. Steve Miller was executed with a bullet to the head. Three German doctors and two French missionaries were killed despite their nationalities, while Foreign Service officer Philip Manhart was paraded through the city and marched to Hanoi, remaining a prisoner until 1973. As official denials continued, brave journalists risked their lives to document the truth about Hugh. Gene Roberts of the New York Times became the first to accurately report that Marines controlled only 2 square blocks of the smoking city while enemy forces maintained control elsewhere. French photojournalist Catherine Leroy took even greater risks. After being captured by front soldiers, a sympathetic officer released her, returned her cameras, and allowed her to photograph his men. Her photos would soon appear on Life magazine's cover. Draft-dodging journalist Mike Morrow witnessed the war's contradictions in the Citadel battlefield. Marines ignoring dying enemy soldiers one moment, then risking their lives for wounded civilians the next. These unflinching accounts began shifting American public opinion. When trusted figures like Walter Cronkite questioned the official narrative, millions of Americans followed suit. Lieutenant Colonel Ernest Big Ernie Cheatham, facing his first urban battle in Hugh, studied warfare manuals after learning of Marine casualties. He assembled city-appropriate weapons, bazookas, recoilless rifles, gas grenades, flamethrowers, and C4 explosives. Cheatham developed an effective pattern: mortar bombardment, his sledgehammer, followed by gas, tanks, Antos vehicles, bazookas, and finally Marines. He used tanks as decoys to expose enemy positions. The Antos, a lightly armored vehicle with 6 recoilless rifles, provided crucial firepower before retreating. Urban combat required adaptation. Marines abandoned traditional flanking in dangerous courtyards and cleared buildings bottom up instead of top down. They avoided obvious entrances, creating new openings with bazookas before methodically clearing rooms with grenades and coordinated fire. In 4 bloody days, Big Ernie fought to the Fukam Canal, his methodical approach reversing the tide in southern Hue, though the ancient citadel across the river remained an even greater challenge. The Battle of Hue devastated civilians, with over 5,800 residents killed, likely an undercount. Deaths came from bombings, crossfire, collapsed bunkers, and executions by both sides. Roughly 80% of the city was destroyed during the 4-week battle. Military casualties were severe. 250 Americans killed and 1,554 wounded, 458 Arvin soldiers killed with 2,700 wounded, and between 2,400 to 5,000 front fighters lost. The combined death toll exceeded 10,000, making Hue the bloodiest battle of the Vietnam War. The shocking destruction contradicted General Westmoreland's optimistic assessments. Walter Cronkite's February 27th broadcast concluded the war was unwinnable, prompting President Johnson to remark, "If I've lost Cronkite, I've lost Middle America." A month later, Johnson announced he wouldn't seek re-election. 50 years later, Hugh warns against prioritizing ideology over regional understanding and optimistic reporting over hard truths. While the fighters' heroism remains undeniable, the exploitation of their idealism by leaders who had lost faith represents a betrayal we must never repeat.